Good evening, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernatitis. I have a 13-year-old son with autism and have been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at age 4. I have served as president of the Autism Society of America Dayton chapter, worked as the assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, and am a regular contributor to Autism Today. There are two ways to listen to tonight's webinar. You can log in to www.momsfightingautism.com, and about halfway down the homepage, you'll see a box that says Register for this webinar. This webinar is completely free. Once registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of the screen, and there you can click Listen In and hear the discussion via the Internet. You can also click Ask a Question if you'd like to submit a question for our speaker. You can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806 and enter conference ID 168978. A list of local call-in numbers is also available on www.instantteleseminar.com/local, and there's a link to that as well on the website. All callers are immediately muted, so you don't have to worry about background noises. We can't hear you. Later in our webinar, I'll let you know how you can ask a question directly to our presenter if you wish. We try to get to as many of the questions and the common themes as we can in the time that we have allotted. We don't have any slides this evening, so just sit back and relax and enjoy yourself. We have allotted 2 hours for tonight's webinar. So without further ado, let me introduce our speaker. Tonight we have Dr. Stephen Shore joining us. He's going to be comparing intervention approaches for children with autism, a view from inside the autism spectrum. I have a little bio to get started here, but I have pages and pages and pages of what Dr. Shore has done, so I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about himself. He was first diagnosed with atypical development with strong autistic tendencies. He was viewed as too sick to be treated as an outpatient on an outpatient basis and recommended for institutionalization. He was nonverbal until the age of 4, and with much help from his parents, teachers, and others, he completed his doctoral dissertation at Boston University, focused on matching best practice to the needs of people on the autism spectrum. Dr. Shore has accepted a professorship at Adelphi University, teaching courses in special education and autism. Welcome, Dr. Shore.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about autism and to talk about my research.
Yeah, why don't you tell us just a little bit more about yourself, what you've been doing lately, or how you got where you are.
All right. After 18 months of typical development, I was hit with what I call the autism bomb, or regressive autism. So what happened is that I lost functional communication, had meltdowns, tantrums, withdrew from the environment, self-stimulatory behavior, and in short, all those characteristics that we see in people on the autism spectrum. In those days, there was very little known about autism. We're talking about when autism was considered to have an incidence rate of 1 in 10,000. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it took my parents a full year to find a place for me to be diagnosed. So by the time 2.5 rolled around, I was diagnosed, and my parents were told that they had never seen a child who was so sick, and the doctors recommended institutionalization. Mm. Fortunately, my parents, like so many parents we see today, advocated on my behalf, refused to send me away, and provided for what we would call today, an intensive home-based early intervention program, emphasizing music, movement, sensory integration, narration, and imitation. If we put it in today's terms, it probably would have looked pretty similar to one of the developmental approaches we have today, such as the Miller method, or perhaps floor time, or RDI. it was with this intervention, again at a time when the concept of early intervention didn't even exist, that my speech had begun to return at age 4, and I entered the school that initially rejected me and recommended institutionalization.
Mm-hmm.
And I also got reevaluated, and instead of being considered as psychotic and various other things, I got upgraded to neurotic, so things were moving up in the world.
Wow.
And so I spent about a year and a half there, and then entered regular school kindergarten at age 6. If they had known then what they knew today, I probably would have spent some of my time in a resource room and the rest of my time in an inclusion situation with an aide, but they didn't know much in those days.
Uh-huh.
And special education wasn't anything you wanted to have anything to do with either. So I just kind of muddled my way through elementary school. The teachers didn't quite know how to reach me. They just saw me as this strange kid. I also had a lot of difficulty interacting with my classmates in a way that they could understand or appreciate. So there was a lot of bullying and teasing going on. Fortunately, these days, people have begun to realize that bullying is not a phase that children need to go through, but actually something should be done about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. As for academics, I was usually about a grade behind in math and in reading. I remember in third grade, for example, I would spend a lot of my time in school just reading books on my favorite subjects. So I go into the library and get all the books out on, say, astronomy, for example. And one day, while I had this stack of astronomy books on my desk, I was busy reading, taking notes, copying diagrams out of, a teacher told me that I'd never learned how to do math. But somehow I figured out just enough math to teach statistics at the university level. So it wasn't, I guess, until middle school that things began to get better. For one, I had figured out that using words instead of sound effects from the environment really helped with social interaction. And I was able to make some friends. I also figured out what teachers wanted in order to properly evaluate me. So grades were beginning to improve. Also in middle school is where you start seeing special interest activities in groups. Music being a special interest of mine, I discovered the band room. And here was a place that I could be successful. This was an activity. This was a very structured activity. Band rehearsals do tend to be very structured. And those of us with autism will be more successful socially in gatherings that are activity-based, as opposed to socially based. So that worked for me. Bicycling was an interest, so I joined a bicycle club. And so things got better in middle and high school. Moving on towards college, college was a utopia, kind of a utopia for me. The bullies were gone. I now had classes that I was interested in. It seemed that people at the college, fellow students, were more interested in who you were, for example, as opposed to how much you were like somebody else. I got through my university undergraduate degrees. I got two of them, one in music and one in accounting.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was on to graduate school and master's in music. And followed by a doctorate, starting a doctorate in music education, but then late in that program, I realized that I ended up defecting to special education to study autism, which I was rapidly becoming interested in. And as we continue, I spent several years, maybe about six or seven, writing books and articles on autism, giving music lessons to children on the autism spectrum, traveling around the country and the world, talking about autism. And a couple of years ago, I accepted a position as an assistant professor of special education at Adelphi University, where I engage in my research in primarily matching best practice to the needs of children on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And with that research, my goal is not to find out which approach is the best, because I find that too many people get over-involved in particular approaches to the exclusion of others, and actually to the detriment of children on the autism spectrum. And what I mean by that is it's certainly fine to be a specialist in a particular approach. Nobody can learn them all equally. But it's also important to be aware that there are other approaches, and the needs of children and adults on the autism spectrum is so incredibly wide that it seems clear that different approaches are going to provide for different needs. And really what we need to focus on is the idea of finding which practice, which approach will best meet the needs of a particular child at this time, because that may change over a period of time, and it may be time to switch to a different approach.
Dr. Shore, when you say best practice, is this like research-based best practice, or what is your definition of best practice in that?
Well, my definition of best practice is reasonably well-researched approaches. And the reason why I say that is because the gold standard in research is evidence-based research.
Mm-hmm.
And there is very little evidence-based research on all the approaches that we have. I mean, there is some for applied behavior analysis. There is none for, at least as far as I can tell, for example, sensory integration therapy. However, I know of dozens, hundreds, thousands of people who will say that sensory integration therapy works for their children. And for those people on the spectrum who are verbal and are aware of their needs, they tell me, too, that sensory integration therapy really helps them. So for that reason, I think it's important to include reasonably well-researched approaches. And for example, as I just mentioned, sensory integration therapy is reasonably well-researched. There's just not much in the way of evidence-based research, and I think we can say that for just about all the approaches that are out there.
Yeah, there's almost an overwhelming amount of therapies now to where parents don't even know where to begin.
Right. Yes, there is there's way too much out there to keep track of, which is, you might say, a benefit of my research, and that is there a way that we can summarize the essence of these approaches and make this available to parents, educators, and others supporting people with autism? And I found that there was no such resource out there, which is why I included this material that I researched and wrote about in my dissertation in my book, Understanding Autism for Dummies.
Mm-hmm. That's right here on my bookshelf.
Well, anybody who wants to get a good introduction with leads to more information about the different approaches, that's a great place to do it, Understanding Autism for Dummies. And it's really written for the parent or the educator who has a child with autism. They read through the number of approaches that I've included in the book, and one person might say, well, I think applied behavior analysis, that fits our family philosophy, and it really looks like that's what our child needs, so I'm going to follow the links and the recommendations of the book to find out more about it. And the next person coming along will say, you know, I really think that the Miller method fits what my child needs. I'm curious about it. I'm going to email Arnold Miller. I'm going to go to his website. I'm going to fill out the Miller Diagnostic Survey and see what that says about my child and see if this is the way to go. And both people will be right because they're focusing on what their child needs.
Mm-hmm. I know families have such a limited amount of money and want to do everything but have to pick and choose. How do they pick and choose? Do they look at what their child's deficits are?
Well, I like to think about looking at what the child's characteristics are.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about deficits of autism, that's using what I like to think of as the old and hopefully soon to be outdated model of looking at autism.
Mm-hmm.
I like to look at autism more as a set of characteristics without focusing on whether their deficits or focusing on their deficits. So that way we can say the child's really good at this, these other things are real challenges. Which approach will best help in this area? So we may have a child who's having difficulty with communication. And I'm aware that the Miller Method, for example, has a quite a substantial program in communication called the Symbol Accentuation Program and other programs, and they can help in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Another child, for example, may have difficulty of going through various physical tasks. And it might make me wonder if a certain amount of discrete trial training might be needed within reason, or perhaps we need to involve an occupational therapist because perhaps the child is unaware of where their body is in relation to the environment. And we have to develop this awareness before we can get on to doing various physical tasks.
Mm-hmm. So in building on strengths, you had mentioned, I read an article about you in EP Magazine, and it was talking about employing their special interests and using their special interests. Like you spoke about your teacher overlooking the fact that you had all these books on your desk that she could have really used them to teach you things. So using a child's special interests is beneficial.
Oh, absolutely.
In building on strengths.
These special interests or passions provide powerful motivators in which to teach a child a curriculum. So the child who is fascinated by astronomy, as in my case, there's certainly plenty of math and reading that can be done and related to astronomy. Suppose you have a child who is fascinated with airplanes and that's all they want to talk about. Is there a way to work mathematics into the discussion of airplanes, such as where they fly, how fast, how long does it take, how much gas is it going to need? These would be examples for math. Another example might be for social studies. Where do airplanes fly? So we fly out to Africa. Now let's take a look at the people of Africa and look at how things work socially over there. It can help with reading, just about everything. And this can be done with other topics of special interest as well.
It just seems so simple.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it seems simple. It isn't always as easy to implement as it is to discuss, but I think
mm-hmm.
it's important to move into this area, move in this direction as much as possible.
So many of these children, like my son, are fascinated with trains. And I can see how you could use trains to do math and reading and everything with just using his fascination.
Oh, absolutely. And you might even be possible to use trains to start working on facial recognition and reading of facial expressions. And the reason why I bring this up is I think back to a child I knew who was fascinated by Thomas the Tank Engine.
Mm-hmm.
And he would set up the video and play the same excerpt of that video over and over. He'd wear out the video. His parents had to have a supply of spare videos in case one broke, because you know it can happen when something doesn't work. And it couldn't just be a copy. It had to be the video that was purchased from the store. And there even had to be a backup VCR machine in case that broke, which sometimes it did. What his parents noted is that when the faces became animated, the child would run out of the room screaming. And my sense is what happened is that the child was getting overloaded with information from the facial changes. We know people with autism often have difficulty with eye contact. And one of the reasons why that difficulty may exist is that that's where a majority of nonverbal communication comes from, around the eyes. And so eventually, it was really interesting, the child eventually taught himself to tolerate the presence of animated faces on Thomas the Tank Engine. And while his parents or I didn't do anything to teach him, for example, how to read facial expressions using Thomas the Tank Engine, I think that that may be a possible entryway in order to do that.
Do you think parents should encourage eye contact if it's so uncomfortable for the child? Insist upon it?
I don't think encouraging is one thing, and that's probably a good thing. Insisting upon it is another.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think eye contact should be insisted upon. Eye contact, for a number of reasons, including the information overload that I mentioned before, is often very difficult for people with autism. So what I suggest is that the person with autism at least start by turning their body towards the person that they're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And at least facing them. Face the front of your body to the person. And that may be something that requires direct instruction for somebody with autism, whereas most other people just sort of figure it out automatically. And then from the body, is it possible to look in the general direction of that person? What about looking around their face, maybe the ear or the shoulder or possibly the nose or the forehead or the mouth? And it isn't necessary to look into the person's eyes if that's really uncomfortable. It may be something that can be it may be possible to develop a tolerance for that later on. Those of us on the spectrum don't receive the information, or at least are unable to have difficulty in processing the information that comes from around the eyes as related to communication. And so in such situations, really, the eye contact or the approximation of eye contact really ends up being for the person who's not on the autism spectrum.
You're so right.
That's a nonverbal signal that tells people who aren't on the autism spectrum that I am talking to you and I'm paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that my son, whether he looks at me or not, is paying attention because he repeats things he shouldn't.
Because
he's listening.
That happens with my music lessons. I spent an hour working with a child on the spectrum trying to do something. It appears he's not paying attention and he's doing everything except attending to the lesson. And then when I come back the following week, the parents report that the child was practicing and trying to do all the things that we did during the lesson.
Yeah. That's funny. You kind of touched on this, but Martina from Virginia asks, what role did your parents play in your recovery, and how did they manage your needs with that of the family?
All right. Well, that's a really good question.
Mm-hmm.
The role that my parents played in my development, and recovery is a kind of can be a sticky word at times, because
yeah.
It sometimes can be hard to define what do we mean by recovery. Are we talking about recovering function? Are we talking about getting to such a point where the autism becomes invisible to other people? And in actuality, I haven't found anybody who's been truly diagnosed to, at any point, be non-autistic. But what I do find is that many people with autism can make incredible strides in terms of productivity, interaction in the environment, and functioning along just like everybody else. But there always seems to be some aspect of autism that we learn how to manage.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, getting back to my parents, I believe that's where it starts. I owe everything to what my parents did on my behalf and to what we now today refer to as intervention. So it really does start with the parents, and it's so important to provide parents the support they need in order to support their children on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you care to share or not, but do you have siblings?
Oh, yeah, siblings. Yeah, that's right, because part of the question had to do with managing the needs of other children. And siblings. And, yeah, I have two siblings. I have a brother who's 2 years older than I am. He was diagnosed with mild to moderate retardation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some autism thrown in for spice as well. He's more significantly affected with whatever he has. And what I mean by that is that at this time he's living in a foster home and works in a supported living situation.
Mm-hmm.
However, he is very verbal, and he enjoys his life, and that's really what's important. And then we move on to my sister, who's the oldest of the three of us. She's 4 years older than I am, and sometimes I wonder if she got all the typical genes in the family. But as I talk to her more about our past and how she is now, I also have realized that, well, she may not be as typical as I might have thought, and maybe even as much as she might have thought in the past. So that's really interesting to discuss. It was a great challenge for my parents because they had two children with special needs of various sorts, and then there is the older daughter who, you know, at that time, didn't have any special needs.
Yeah.
And that was challenging for my sister to work through. It took her a while to work through these things. And now we're at a point where the two of us can talk and laugh about what happened and talk about our interpretations of certain events and find out that the two of us had totally different ideas or thoughts as to why things were, and different interpretations, and it's good to work those out.
That is certainly something that families struggle with when they have a mixture of needs.
Oh, yes.
Is, you know, the balance, the you're getting more attention than I am.
And that is a struggle. And what I see happening a lot is these parents who desperately try to treat all their children equally. And sometimes I wonder if equal is being confused with fair.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is that I see all these poor parents turning themselves inside out, saying, well, I'm spending an hour in therapy with this child, so what am I going to do about the other child? And how am I going to make this up? And really, I think if a parent can honestly say to themselves and could honestly say to the child who might be feeling a little bit left out, that, you know, if you were in need of speech therapy or OT or whatever it might be, I'd do the same thing for you. That doesn't ignore the fact that it's also important to make sure that there is quality time with the sibling who doesn't have autism.
Right.
And are there ways for the parent to engage with this, with their other child who doesn't have autism or special needs, in quality time, just doing things together?
Mm-hmm.
So that's important too.
I, as you know, have three kids, two typical kids, and then my third child has autism. And even before my third child was born, when I would hear that, it's not fair, it's not fair, I would say, you get what you need when you need it. Just because she gets new shoes doesn't mean you need new shoes.
Right.
That kind of thing. And I think that really helped once Sam did come along and his needs were great, that they understood you get what you need when you need it.
Right, and that's a great thing that you did, sort of like, pre-planning.
I didn't even know.
Inadvertently, yeah. like setting the stage, and that's great. And I see these challenges happening in school, too, where, for example, an educator might say, why do I have to provide this child with a copy of my notes or time and a half for a test or some other accommodation when I'm not doing it for everybody else? It's not fair. And really the issue of fairness is what do the other children need?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the standard of fairness, not treating everybody equally.
Right.
You can take this as an example. Richard Lavoie talks about this in his video, Fat City. How difficult can this be? In his example, he takes a bit of an extreme case in an adult situation where suppose he's giving a lecture to several dozen people. And as he's giving this lecture, God forbid, one of the participants falls out of their chair and turns blue. And she's having cardiac arrest. And he knows how to give CPR, so he can save this woman's life. But as this woman is lying there turning blue, he says, you know, I'm sorry. I'm really, really sorry. I'd love to give you CPR. I know how to do it. I can save your life. But I really don't have time to give CPR to these several other dozen people, and it wouldn't be fair not to provide it to them and only to you. And that's a real stark example of providing for needs. And
exactly.
As a result, to be fair, you end up treating people differently.
A lot of families have asked, or a lot of parents have asked, about educational options. When you bring up, you know, the teacher wanting it to be fair,
right.
You know, it makes me think, you know, with this avalanche of autism diagnoses coming down the hill, it just seems like we're woefully behind in educating these children. I know that you visited a school yesterday, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah, it was a very exciting school.
Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. This school is the first residential school in New York State for children on the autism spectrum, children with Asperger syndrome, children who are more verbal. A lot of people would refer to these students as being high-functioning, but I don't really like to use the term high and low-functioning because they don't really accurately describe the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, these are verbal children who are cognitively able to make it through a school curriculum. However, the challenges of being on the autism spectrum make it impossible for them to do that in a typical school or even a regular school that is providing accommodations. So this is a this is a private residential school.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there. I'm on their board. I'm on their board mm-hmm. of directors, and they asked me if I'd come and do some workshops for them, which I said, yeah, sure. You know, that's part of my boardly duties, training the staff and working with the kids whenever possible. So a couple of weeks ago, I think it was a day or two before they opened, I gave a workshop to the staff on self-advocacy and disclosure, which is something that transition age, and that's where these students are, they're transition age students. And then coming back a couple of weeks later, instead of doing the same workshop but for the students, because they're not quite ready for that yet, they thought it would be good if I just came by and essentially just got to meet the students, hang out with them, socialize, have dinner, and essentially have a good time. And that's exactly what I did. I found this set of really neat students on the autism spectrum with wonderful interests, wonderful people, and certainly there are challenges there, and I think the school will go far in helping these students overcome their challenges.
When you said it was a residential, do the students live there?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a residential school. It has a capacity of, I think, 24 students. One floor is the boys' floor, you might say, and the other floor is the girls' floor.
Mm-hmm.
And so they live there. The name of the school is Westbrook, by the way.
Okay.
And it's in Westbury, New York, which is on Long Island,
mm-hmm.
Near Adelphi University, where I teach.
Very nice. Have you visited a lot of schools in your travels?
A fair amount. I do a number of teacher workshops.
Have you seen, I'm sure you've seen all the good, the bad, and the ugly, right?
Oh, I've seen it all, yeah. Yeah, I've seen great stuff everywhere. I mean, in New Zealand, I saw this great school that focuses on children's strengths in order to give them an education, and a number of their kids on the spectrum were heading off towards college, which was really good. I've seen other areas where there were significant challenges, where there was very little in the way of support from the government or society, and I've even been to places where they wouldn't let me visit the school because, I don't know, maybe they were afraid of what I might see. They just told me they weren't ready to accept visitors.
Wow, that's scary.
Yeah, that is.
It's very scary. We have a question from Susan in Kenya.
Yeah, oh, in Kenya, okay.
In Kenya, yeah. She says she would like to establish a special needs school to cater for all categories and relieve parents of the burden of hiding their children with special needs at home. Is there any organization that you know of that can give her a helping hand?
I wish I knew of one off the top of my head. I know the problems are pretty significant in Kenya, and what she's describing is, you know, it falls true from what I hear of what is going on in Kenya. One thing she might want to consider is coming to a conference I'm giving a keynote at in the capital of Namibia, the International Association of Special Education is holding an international special education conference in Namibia from July, I think it's the 9th to the 11th or thereabouts. I don't remember exactly the date.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something worth checking out, and people from all over the world come to this conference to present and to learn about helping students with special needs. And given the fact that it's in Africa, I suspect that there'll be a large number of people from that continent, and that could be a great place to build connections, to network, and to learn. And if this parent is able to make it to this conference, I hope she comes up to me and introduces herself to me.
That would be wonderful, wouldn't it? Now remember,
that would be great.
Susan from Kenya.
Kenya.
When she comes up and introduces herself, she'll say, I'm Susan from Kenya.
Yeah, I hope she does.
That would be wonderful. I want to know if she does. In talking about education, there's Gail from Washington asks, in the school setting, elementary, high school, what were some of the most effective methods used by the OT or teaching staff to assist with classroom communication? She wants to know, did you experience OT intervention? And if so, what do you remember best? Was it the sensory work, heavy work activities? Did you even have OT when you were in school?
OT didn't exist at that time. Jean Ayres was just getting started on her ideas with occupational therapy. I guess the best approximation I can get to it was to say that I functionally did my own OT. And I would spend a lot of time swinging on swings, riding my bicycle, getting a lot of big body movement by climbing trees, jumping off of swings, and things like that. The interesting thing about OT is that students tend to self-select the type of therapy or therapeutic activity that they need, which I think is really neat. Putting a variation on that question, I think it would have been really helpful if OT did exist and I did get OT in the classroom or through the school.
Very interesting. So kind of like Temple Grandin's squeeze machine, she knew what she needed and she invented it.
Exactly. And that's what a lot of us had to do in those days, and I'm sure in a number of ways people on the autism spectrum still have to do.
Yeah, we just kind of happened upon that my son had sensory issues when he would stand behind us on the couch and pull us against him and say, squish.
Yeah.
He wanted deep pressure.
Right, and that's what he sensed it, and he knew it, and he figured out how to get it.
Mm-hmm. And just felt so wrong sitting back against him, but that's what he liked.
Right.
Still on the topic of school, Roseanne from Texas asks, knowing what you know from your own personal experiences and from your expertise and research in the area, what would be the ideal school setting for an elementary-aged child with Asperger's? What would a day in this school look like?
I think an ideal school setting would be one where educators are attuned to what the student needs. Learning would take place in a multi-sensory sort of fashion,
mm-hmm.
so involving as many senses as possible in the lessons. There'd be a lot of student involvement and very little teacher lecturing and students trying to absorb stuff, but perhaps more learning by doing and by experiencing. I'd also like to see a lot of situations where students work in groups, so that there's opportunity for peer tutoring of various ways. Every student would have an IEP, whether they had special needs or not, because
mm-hmm.
every student does have their own learning preferences, learning styles, and needs. There'd also be frequent opportunities to move. People are not made to sit in chairs for long periods of time, least of all people on the autism spectrum. And as I think about some of these ideal characteristics in a school, I think what I just described would benefit every student, whether they had Asperger's, autism, or special needs or not.
That is so true. I can remember my typical kids, and I thought that they both needed personalized education, a personalized education plan.
Yeah.
Not one size fits all.
Right, definitely isn't. A lot of situations, people try to teach to the middle third of the class, hoping that the top third will, well, they've already figured it out, and the bottom third, well, we're not too sure what we can do with it. I don't think that's an efficient or effective way to educate.
How right you are. I've been reading through the questions, and a common theme happens to be repetitive, stereotypical STEMI behaviors and how to reduce them or stop them. And I noticed in this article in the magazine, it was talking about self-stimulatory behavior or self-regulatory behaviors. And it says that many parents and educators try to stop STEMs before they understand the purpose they serve. I found that whole section of the article very interesting because just trying to stop it isn't really the way to go, is it?
No. And as a matter of fact, you can't do it. It's almost guaranteed that if you stop a STEM, whatever it is, something else is going to pop out, and whatever pops out is going to be even more intrusive and difficult to deal with. So really what we need to do is we need to figure out what need is that self-stimulatory behavior fulfilling. And then two, if what the child is doing is disruptive, distractive, intrusive in a particular situation, is there another way to meet the need? And then two, if there really isn't, is there a way that the child can stim in a more appropriate place, perhaps at home, for example?
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to realize that these self-stimulatory behaviors are not the exclusive domain of people on the autism spectrum. And in fact, everybody engages in self-stimulatory behavior. And what I mean by that is anyone, for example, who bounces their leg while sitting in a chair, doodles, plays with their hair, bites the end of their pen, these are all self-stimulatory behaviors. It's just that one way to look at them is instead of calling them self-stimulatory behavior, perhaps thinking of them as self-regulatory behaviors would be better.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are bouncing their leg, for example, they may be doing that to calm themselves down. They might be a little anxious, and the repetitive movements calm them down. Or maybe they're just sitting so long, or it was a late night the night before, and they're trying to keep themselves awake. The difference between adults and those not on the autism spectrum and those on the autism spectrum is that adults who don't have autism have figured out how to stim in a socially acceptable manner. And bouncing your leg is certainly a socially acceptable manner. Flapping one's hands, on the other hand, not that there's anything inherently wrong with it, sometimes it may not be socially appropriate. Unless, of course, you're on The Price is Right, you get called down to the front, and then you kind of stand up and scream and jump up and down and run, and the hands are flapping. It's a good flap.
That is true. I never thought about that before.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some real flapping going on.
There definitely is.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about it before, but that's socially acceptable in that environment.
Yes, it is.
That's very funny. Let's see, what else? There's a lot of questions here about echolalia, and you spoke about, in this article, about echolalia, echopraxia, and echomotica.
Yes. And echolalia, it's often seen as considered as a pathway to functional communication. Every child, actually, as a toddler, goes through a period of echolalia. It's just that most toddlers get in and out of it. They pass through it in a very short period of time, and it's not noticed. But those of us on the spectrum tend to get stuck in it. If we take a look at the work of Arnold Miller, he suggests that echolalia might be a sort of fusion with the environment, because people who are being a Hillelic, I usually aren't aware that it's happening.
Hmm.
And they're just repeating sounds that are unprocessed from the environment. And I know I went through a period of echolalia, and my mother telling me that I didn't have to do what parrots did.
Oh.
and the other types of echolalia that I mentioned, one is echopraxia, that's copying other people's movements, and we see that happening sometimes. And the third one, echo emotica, is a word that I made up. However, what it describes is the tendency of people with autism to fuse to another person's emotions. Now, we know that young children do this. If we get up in a bad mood or on the wrong side of the bed, we know that whether it's your child or whether it's your students, that they'll tend to reflect that mood right back at you, as if it's coming from them, even though it isn't. Now, that happens with people on the autism spectrum as well, or it often does. I've talked with other adults on the spectrum, and they report the same thing happens to them. So what that means, at least for me, is that I have to go through a cognitive step, and that is if I feel an emotion that's out of context with the environment, I have to look around and see if that emotion is coming from somebody else. I might, for example, have to ask my wife, gee, are you feeling anxious about something? And often she'll say, yeah, I am. And what I'll be able to do at that point is instantly be able to separate from that emotion, but at the same time feel for her. And what most people call that is empathy. And for me, it requires this, you might say, cognitive two-step to get there, whereas for other people it happens automatically. And I believe what this idea of echo emotica, it really flies in the face with the persistent myth that people with autism either don't feel or have emotions. I think through this echo emotica type of concept, perhaps those of us on the autism spectrum feel another's emotions as much as anybody else, or perhaps even more so. And the real challenge is, what do we do with this emotion? And how do we process it? That's where the difficulty comes in. As a matter of fact, there was a fascinating study where they measured the reaction of, or I should say reactions of young children, I believe it was toddler age, to the emotions of others. And they found that children who had an intellectual disability, which used to be called mental retardation, had certain responses in their skin and in heart rate to other people's emotions. And then when they hooked up children with autism, they found that these children had the same, you might say, internal body reactions, differences in heart rate, differences in skin electrical conductivity as the others. However, they showed no outward signs. So what it means is that there may be a disconnect on between registering the emotion and then understanding what to do with it.
Wow. Now, is it also called echolalia when someone is scripting something that they've heard, like scripting a movie or scripting a conversation?
That's a form of what is known as delayed echolalia. So something that they heard and then referring back to it. And I know some children, for example, who will have a sort of inventory of phrases from movies and other sources that they'll use, and they'll attempt to choose the phrase that fits most closely to a given situation. And it doesn't always fit.
Yeah.
Sometimes it fits really well. So that's an interesting use of an echolalic tendency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my son in particular started saying dang when he would see a big truck or something interesting, and he would just say dang, and I couldn't figure out where he'd heard that. You don't say that. My daughter said, Joe Dirt, the movie, he had heard that phrase in the movie and was using it appropriately to say, that's a really big truck.
Oh, that's interesting.
But he couldn't say, wow, that's a really big truck. So he just said, dang.
So it's kind of
funny how they can get by with scripting on occasion.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
It is quite fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to be your research assistant.
All right, that sounds good to me.
Can I wear a lab coat?
No, you can wear a lab coat. You can join a student who's applied to Adelphi University from Israel because she's interested in studying and joining me in my research in autism.
It's so very fascinating.
Oh, I think so. It really is.
Teaching empathy. There's quite a few questions here from parents who want to know how on earth do they teach their child to empathize. One child is physically hurting mom, and she can't relay that hurts, that sort of thing.
Right.
How do you teach empathy?
Yeah, well, that can be a hard one.
Yeah.
And the thing to do is not in the moment while something is happening or the child is hurting the mother, because the child isn't in any position to really process these things. But at a time when the child is calm and more available, to talk about these things. How do you think mommy feels when you, whatever, pull her hair or doing whatever it is to hurt her? And conversations like that can begin to teach empathy. Also watching videos, watching movies, and talking about what is happening in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And how might the other person feel at this particular point? That could be another possible way as well.
You also mentioned in this article social stories.
That's right.
I think that would be helpful.
Yeah, various social narratives. Social stories are one, power cards are another, cartooning is yet another. And social narratives can be used to teach empathy and also to teach protocol for various social situations.
Hmm. I know that we struggled with whether we should use real-life pictures of things or if cartoons were acceptable, cartoon drawings of, say, a banana, or should we use actual pictures of bananas when we were introducing, you know, words. Anything with emotions, should we use actual people's faces, or should, you know, is a drawing suitable?
Well, some children seem to work better with drawings, and others seem to work better with realistic pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it depends on the individual. I know there are some programs that exist that can help teach the recognition of facial expressions, which can also be helpful, written by Simon Baron Cohen.
Hmm. Is it software or?
It's software, yes.
For the computer, okay.
Right. I can't think of the specific name. Maybe it's even called Faces. But by Googling autism, Simon Baron Cohen, and facial recognition software, I'm sure you'd be able to hone right in on it.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever try any of the special diets or anything when you were at any time? Have you ever taken yourself off gluten, for instance?
No, I never have. And I know there's a lot of controversy about diets.
Mm-hmm.
And the closest thing I might have had to that was when I was younger, I remember having some gut issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I would complain that my sides hurt, which probably translates to indigestion. And the doctor recommended that I be given liquids for some period of time. Maybe it was 2 weeks. I don't remember exactly how long. Had they known about gluten and casein-free diets at that time, it's likely that they might have helped. And I think with GFCF diets, with various other biomedical type of interventions, it's really a case of proceeding cautiously and providing for what the child needs. I know some people who, when they go off their GFCF diet, they become a total disaster area.
Yeah.
And then there are others who are on the seafood diet. And that is, we see food and we eat it.
Yes. I'm on that one.
Yeah, it's a good diet to be on.
Going through some more of these questions.
All right.
It does seem that literal thought is quite common. You have an awesome sense of humor. My son has an awesome sense of humor. He gets the silly Ace Ventura slapstick stuff. He gets jokes. But a lot of our kids are very, very literal. Like you're talking about the dropping of the E at the end of the word.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you want to tell that story? It's pretty cute.
Yeah, I certainly do. I remember in grade school becoming awfully concerned about the letter E because I heard that you have to drop E before adding ing, and I was just so worried about that E was going to get hurt, and wasn't it poor social skills to be pushing letters around like that? And that was a case of literal thinking. And I think it's a sort of developmental phase where a person may not have, might not quite understand the concept of what an idiom is and may still have difficulty reading the small nonverbal cues that inform one when someone is telling a joke, for example, or using sarcasm. I remember another time, and this was in middle school, it was in high school. It was during homeroom. And somebody came in and announced that the principal had lost his mother. And that caused me to think back about when I would lose things. And I asked my parents, whatever it was that I lost, and the predictable answer would be, well, it was wherever you left it, which I always thought was a very silly answer because if I knew where I'd left it, then I wouldn't be asking the question. But anyways, thinking back to my parents' response to losing things, my response was, well, maybe if the principal thought really, really hard as to where he last saw his mother, he could go back there and she'd probably still be right there. So... needless to say, the results weren't pretty.
Yeah. I can see how that would be a problem.
And it's these literal interpretations of language that can often get people with autism in trouble, where it may be assumed that they're being fresh or a wise guy or being disrespectful, whereas in fact they're just interpreting language literally. And how do we help with that? One might be talking about idioms, getting a book of idioms. I know there's some books out there, and going through them. What does it really mean when someone says to wait a minute? Is it really just waiting a minute? And what does it really mean when someone says to hold on? Does that mean that you have to hold on to something?
Exactly.
So it's really discussing these and analyzing them. People with autism are often good at analyzing things, so analyzing these idioms one by one can be very helpful.
It sounds a lot like the work of Brenda Smith Miles and the HID curriculum.
Oh, it's hugely that type of work.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an excellent way of describing this concept, the hidden curriculum, the rules that everybody knows, nobody talks about, and you become a social outcast if you don't understand these rules.
Mm-hmm.
The world is full of hidden curriculum. And as a matter of fact, it's much easier to point out where hidden curriculum doesn't exist than to talk about where it does exist, because it exists everywhere.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think of all the things that we just pick up on intuitively, but that we actually have to teach our kids.
Right.
The don't get in my bubble type of information, and just all the social rules, how close to stand to somebody in line, and you know, all there's so many hidden curriculum items that are just, I can't even, you know, fathom how many I would have to teach. But she makes a calendar, a day-by-day calendar, that's really good. It's like one a day.
Oh, yes.
It address one topic a day in the hidden curriculum.
Right. That can be doable. Yes, it is.
That, for me, is doable. One a day.
Yes, exactly. As a matter of fact, I have a little video on a part of hidden curriculum, and in particular, it's the men's room.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis DeBott and I have teamed up to create a video on safe travel for people on the autism spectrum, and there are all these rules that you're expected to follow, and that you need to follow if you want to travel safely, whether it's just walking down Main Street in your own town, whether it's in a supermarket, it could be a library, or a train station, an airport, or in an airplane. There are just certain things that you do and certain things you don't do. And part of traveling also means sometimes just having to go to the restroom. And for us guys, and for ladies as well, there are certain rules that people are expected to follow. If you don't follow these rules, then you can get into trouble very, very quickly. So that's one thing that's also part of our video. It's G-rated, so everybody can watch it.
Where would people find this video? They were interested.
Well, people are interested in this video. You're going to have to wait probably until maybe the middle of this year when production is finally complete. We've done just about all of the shooting, and it essentially is just waiting to be all put together. However, those who want to view the bathroom scene, proper bathroom behavior in the men's room, you can find that either on YouTube or on my Facebook page.
Do you also have a website?
I do have a website. And the website has articles. It also lists the different presentations I do. I have about 15 different presentations covering various topics. And the website address is www.autismasperger.net. And the autism and Asperger is just one word. They get jammed together. And it's Asperger in the singular as opposed to Asperger's with an S.
Okay.
And that's my website.
All right. Yeah, I would recommend everyone go there. A lot of information.
And I have my books. I have my four publications on that website. Also, recommendations for various other books. And then whenever possible, and I haven't been that good at this, I try to keep an updated list of where I'm traveling to give presentations.
Wonderful. I realized at the beginning of this article and the beginning of our discussion, I should have asked you this question, but I'm going back for it because I find it so very interesting. People are trying to basically pull their child back into this world. Okay, they're going into themselves, their own world, and when you were very, very young, you were like that. You were trying to go into yourself. And the things that your mother did to bring you out to get you to pay attention to her are very interesting to me. You talk about you wouldn't imitate her, so she began to imitate you.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think that's a very important concept. When she found that I was not imitating her, she flipped it around and began to imitate me. Once I did that, I became aware of her in my environment. And the important educational implication is that before any good teaching goes on, you have to develop a trusting relationship with the learner. And it's this trusting relationship that then allows you to pull the child, and it will be at their pace, into you might say, the greater world.
You say here, even if that means stemming with the student.
That's correct. So if it means getting on the floor and flapping your hands with them until they notice you, then that's exactly what you do. It doesn't mean that you're going to flap all day, every day, but the point is to get noticed by that student, start developing interactions, moving from parallel play to interactive play, and pulling that student into, you might say, the greater world.
I think that's an awesome concept. Work with the student.
Right. I mean, you don't really, it's very difficult to work against anything. Against the student, that's very difficult. It's even very difficult to work against the characteristics of autism, so we might as well use them. So, for example, when I give music lessons to children with autism, a number of these students have a really strong need to complete tasks or to complete a project. And that's common for autism in general. So what I do is I harness that desire for completion. And one example of that might be to place little yellow stickies with the note names on a piano keyboard. And we'll start with the first note, which on a full-size keyboard is an A. Oh, gee, what comes after A? And it's a B, so can you stick a B onto the next key of the piano? What comes next? And now could you finish the job? And the challenge will be to, for example, interrupt the student before they're finished rather than allowing the student to just finish the job. And that's what I mean by using the characteristic of the need for completion to my advantage rather than trying to fight it.
It's just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And your mother was also brilliant.
Yeah, she was, and she still is.
Yeah. She needs to be on one of my webinars.
Yeah, she needs to write a book.
She really does.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just what she did intuitively is just amazing.
Oh, it really is.
I think it is. I commend her. Give her a call tonight and tell her I commend her.
Yeah, I'll do that, yeah. Be glad to.
I want to let callers know that are calling, listening on their telephones, that you can press *2 to raise your hand at any time and ask a question live here with Dr. Shore. So as soon as I see some hands raised, I will take some live calls.
Yeah.
And don't be shy, don't be embarrassed. We're just hanging out here having a chat.
Yeah, the first question is always the hardest.
It is. You say here that structure is vital for people with autism, and I found that myself. Do you think having a classroom set up like Teach, using a lot of pictures, a lot of structure, is very helpful?
I think structured teaching can be very helpful. The pictures are great for students who process information more easily through graphics as opposed to words. The pictures can also be used to transition to word-based, you might say, processing or understanding of information by including the word along with the picture. As you suggested, structure is very, very important for people with autism to be successful. Structure and predictability. However, it's also important to realize that the world is not just one big structured activity, and that there is unpredictability in, through our daily lives. And to that end, I find the Miller Method very interesting in that regard, because the focus is on teaching the child, educating the child to deal with unpredictable situations. So varying amounts of disorder will be brought into a therapy session, into a classroom, for example, and then the supports will be given to the child to enable them to work through this period or instance of disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that fascinating because there's a lot of disorder in the world. For example, there's a traffic jam and you're going to be late, or there's a detour and you have to go get to a location going a different way. And how are we going to cope with that?
Yeah, road construction really messes my child up. It could take him a week to get over it.
Yeah. I mean, these things can be very difficult. And what a Miller Method practitioner would do is find ways to start introducing very mild types of disorder into a therapy session, for example. And then how are we going to fix this type of disruption to the order? And all the way to what is considered as catastrophic disorder. And one fun one that they do is what's called the mucked up classroom. And what will happen is that before the students get into a classroom, the teachers will go in and turn the desks upside down and the chairs on their sides and strew trash all around the floor. And then when the students come into the room, they'll act really surprised. Oh, gee, what has happened to this room? Help me fix this. Let's fix the room. And they'll provide support to the child to put everything upright again. There are other children who may not be able to tolerate a completely mucked up classroom, and maybe they just start with one chair turned on its side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a good way to introduce the concept of introducing disorder into a classroom situation, and it's something that I do at the college level when I teach different approaches, and in particular when I teach the Miller Method. And I'll start the day, I'll do the very same thing before class starts on the day that we're going to talk about the Miller Method. I'll go in and turn the chairs upside down and upend the tables and rip up pieces of paper towels and strew them all over the floor and turn the waste baskets on their side. And it's interesting to see the student reactions. And the most common reaction is that the students won't go into the room. Afraid to go in. And some students, for example, tell me that, well, they thought somebody had a bad reaction to a test grade.
Uh-huh.
Or they were about to call security because they don't know what happened. They won't go in.
That's
and,
funny.
What I'll do is I'll make sure to arrive to class maybe 5 minutes late. They're all standing outside. Let's all go in. Let's go in. We got class to do. Let's go in. Oh, what a mess. What a mess. Let's clean it up. Let's clean it up. Here's some rubber gloves for the trash.
Go ahead.
And then I talk to them about how this mucked up classroom made them feel, and the idea that, however they felt, children with autism, that feeling has probably increased at least 100 or 1,000 times.
It's kind of like Wright State University looked after our conference.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I remember.
Wow, that was mucked up.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, that was a fun conference.
Okay, we have some hands raised here, so I'm going to click on the caller. There's a slight delay after I click on you, but I'll announce that you're on, and if you would say your first name and where you're calling from, and then you have the floor. I lost that one.
No, maybe they got scared.
Yeah. Hello, caller. Okay, let me refresh.
All right.
to raise your hand, you press star 2. So anytime that you'd like to ask a question, you can raise your hand, and I will click on you, and then we will ask your question. Oh, here we are.
All right.
Hello.
Hi, caller.
Hi.
Go ahead and state your name and where you're calling, your first name and where you're calling from, and then you've got the floor.
Hi, I'm Lucy from Brooklyn, New York.
Welcome.
Hi. I have a young son. He's 2, diagnosed with autism, PDD, NOS, and he has some sensory issues. That's what I'm told. When we go to a new place, like a friend's home, a new restaurant, any new environment, he has meltdowns. He gets really agitated. We just think that, oh, he just has to get used to this place. But it happens all the time. And basically we're just afraid of going out with him because we're afraid of him having a meltdown and getting upset and getting everybody else upset as well. And he's in a nursery school. He's getting intervention with a special education teacher, ABA, OT, speech. I tried talking to the OT, and she says, it's sensory, and I have to try to figure out what is sensory, because everything seems to be blamed on sensory. And we're just trying to figure out how do we get him to cope when he goes to a new environment, a restaurant, stuff like that. And happy birthday. He hates happy birthdays. He hates birthday celebrations. His sister just turned 9 yesterday. We went out, and we had to tell the waiter, listen, when you're about to come back saying happy birthday, let us know so we can run to the bathroom with him. And, of course, the sister got upset because we were in the bathroom, and they were singing happy birthday at the table, and I wasn't there, and she's, like, upset with him. And I'm trying to get her to understand that he couldn't deal with it. So how do we deal with this? Please help.
All right. Well, there seem to be quite significant challenges. Sometimes a practitioner will view all of a child's challenges through their particular lens. So an occupational therapist will focus on sensory. An ABA practitioner will focus on compliance. A Miller Method practitioner will, for example, focus on the need to learn how to cope with a disorder. And really, it seems that that's what the child needs. Of course, I have not observed the child, so it's hard to give specific recommendations. What I would do is, looking at the sensory end of things, conversation with the occupational therapist as to what your son's, this is your son, is that right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. What is your son's sensory issues? What are his challenges? And what is being done to help him cope with his challenges? Then I would ask the ABA practitioner a similar question, not on sensory, but what can be done in order to help my son deal with novel situations? And this is where I'd start. I'd also think about finding ways to introduce some mild sorts of disorder into his world. Not so much that they overwhelm him, which is what's happening when you're traveling to other places, but enough so that he's aware of it, and then providing him with the tools in which to cope with this mild disorder. And I think this is what I would do to start setting him on his way.
Okay. Did that help, Lucy?
Well, yeah, kind of. I've spoken to the ABA teacher just today, and, you know, she gave me some suggestions, you know, going out with him and trying to be consistent and seeing how he reacts and just trying to be consistent on going to, you know, a specific location that I'm having trouble with and getting him used to it.
Yeah, just maybe small bites.
Yeah.
It also may be important to make sure that he understands what is happening. If that often is the cause of many a meltdown. So, for example, if you're going to go to a store to buy a gallon of milk, then it would be important to tell him and show him using pictures or however he communicates that this is what we're going to do. We're going to get into the car. We're going to drive to this store. We're going to get a gallon of milk. Don't succumb to the temptation to do any other shopping, but just that one thing, and then we are leaving and going home.
Yeah, that's exactly what she said. She just said, stick to what you're going to go and do, what you say you're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, definitely be clear in what you're going to do, and do it. And it might just be a very, very short trip. It might even just be a trip to the end of the driveway and back. It depends where he lives.
It depends where he is.
I said Liz because I'm thinking that you're just 13 miles away from where I am here in Williston Park.
Okay,
yeah.
That sounds like some good starting points.
Yeah.
Good. Well, thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know when Sam was little, and we didn't have a diagnosis yet. We took him to the older children's baseball games.
Mm-hmm.
And when the parents would yell, go, Sam heard no, and he would scream.
Oh, yeah.
And I finally realized why it upset him so badly when he heard that word. And so actually, instead of trying to help him, all the other parents just changed their behavior.
Oh,
and nobody yelled go. They would yell anything but go.
Right.
And at that point it solved our problem. But it was funny how all the adults modified their behavior to keep the baby from crying. It was kind of funny.
Yeah, it is. That's great on their part.
Okay, we'll take another call. Hello, caller.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead and state your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Vanessa, and I'm calling from Maryland.
Okay, and what is your question?
I had a question about echolalia. I'm so glad you all spoke on it. When my son was diagnosed at the age of 3, he demonstrated a significant amount of echolalia, and he's now 8. And he still does the same thing. He uses words appropriately in situations. So my question is, does the child grow out of echolalia, or does it just progress? Will he always demonstrate this?
Well, that's a good question. And unfortunately, it's not a really easy one to answer because each person has their own developmental trajectory.
Okay.
And it's hard to predict, especially if without an observation and spending time with him, as to where he's going to go in terms of echolalia in this case.
Right.
If, for example, he's scripting and using words or phrases from, say, a movie,
mm-hmm.
in a particular situation, and even if it's spot on for being appropriate as to the situation, what I might do is ask him, is there another way that you can say that?
Okay. Well, actually, what he's doing is he's taking his vocabulary is very extensive, and he's taking the larger words, and he's using them appropriately.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Educators are just baffled because of his vocabulary. And I know that, you know, we don't speak to him like an 8-year-old. We use adult words, and sometimes he will stop and ask us. He'll say, you need to use words that that kids understand. And I tell him the meaning of the word, and he retains it. And he takes all of this in, and throughout the years, he has retained all of these words, and now they're just coming out, and everyone is baffled. So I feel it's echolalia, and it's been echolalia, but my therapist, his speech therapist, I thought indicated that echolalia ended at a certain age.
Well, and developmentally, it's supposed to end while the child's still a toddler, but that's typical development. With autism, developmental trajectories can take all sorts of different paths.
Okay.
So for some people with autism, they'll remain echolalic for the rest of their lives.
Okay.
With others, less so. I think what is most important is that your son is communicating appropriately.
Yeah.
If his vocabulary is beyond what an 8-year-old should be, then, well, I guess there are worse problems in the world.
Exactly. Right.
That when he gets older, it will sort of even itself out.
Right. Well, I'm in awe with it. I really am, and I'm just really happy, but I was just confused about the term echolalia and thinking that it ended. And in my mind, I'm thinking it hasn't ended for him. So this just confirms what I've been thinking all along. So I'm so happy that you spoke on it and just confirmed what I was thinking.
Well, mommy knows best.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you. Don't we all, to some extent, use echolalia?
Yeah, I believe so.
I know. If I hear a funny line in a movie and it sticks and it's appropriate, I use it a lot.
Right. Yeah, well, that also may demonstrate the genetic properties of autism and the traits traveling in families, and it's a well-known fact that parents get their autism from their kids.
Absolutely. Yeah, I see tendencies in everybody now.
Well, everybody's got them. Everyone has some autistic characteristics. Some people have more than others. If there are so many that it negatively interferes with functioning on a regular basis, then it's time to think about a diagnosis and intervention.
Mm-hmm. When it interferes with quality of life.
Right.
Okay, well, we have another hand raised. Let's see who this is. Welcome, caller.
Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Do you want to state your first name and where you're calling from?
This is Lucy, and I'm calling from Dallas, Texas.
Okay, and what is your question today?
I have a question. My son is 8. He just turned 8 this year, and he's been diagnosed for a little less than a year with autism. He also has an OCD, and he also has a lot of sensory with clothes and sensory issues in clothes and environment. But he is having problems in school. He's to an extreme that he has been physically abused and verbally. Physically is because I just recently found a bruise on his arm, but he was pulled by the teacher. Mm-hmm. And verbally is because his name is just replaced with the boy from the moon. And I was suspecting something was happening because he started like 5 months ago, and he's regressing. He's doing a lot of stuff he wasn't doing anymore. And he's not speaking. He's not expressing what he used to tell me. You know, something happened, he would say it in his own words, and I would understand what he was telling me because I knew how he was talking already.
Mm-hmm.
But the issues are right now is I don't know if I should still send him to school. Well, his school is telling me that he's not going to be treated any special or any different than other kids until he gets testing there. But I can't. Every time I drop him off, is I can't get it off my mind that his little life right now and so the hours that he spends at school are miserable. I mean, I don't know if I should still send him to school or keep him until he gets tested or, what else? he's telling me that he's not the boy from the moon anymore. I mean, he still lives, but they don't call him that anymore. And, I don't really understand. I mean, how can they, instead of helping him, tell me that he's misbehaving because he doesn't want to do work? It's just like the doctor mentioned that if he can't go into another assignment, if he hasn't finished what he's doing first, and he can't focus on anything else until he finishes that. And they don't understand that. I guess he's misbehaving because he's refusing to do work. Also, he has another big issue on using the restroom without taking his clothes off.
Mm-hmm.
And, they don't understand. I mean, he has to use the restroom, but he has to take everything off. So he gets in trouble for that. And
How old is he?
He's 8. Turned 8 in January. Yeah.
And he's not on an IEP or anything yet?
No, not yet. They haven't. Ever since he started school, I've been asking, requesting, but they haven't done anything. No.
What do you think, Dr. Shore?
Well, I think he needs an IEP.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as possible. It's an emergency situation. He needs, if there's abuse, that needs to be investigated right away. Because that's just something that can't be tolerated. And it really sounds like he's not getting his needs met. And it may be that it's time to find an advocate in order to get the process moving along.
Okay, I did research and I did call an advocacy place here in Dallas, and they told me is this was like an abuse. I needed to report it to like the CPS, but then I called CPS and they told me that they can't investigate teachers. I have no idea why. They just investigate parents abusing kids, but they don't investigate teachers abusing kids. And I don't know where to go anymore.
Well, I would suggest, because I'm not familiar with the laws in Texas, is you contacting the local Autism Society of America chapter. And they should be able to put you in touch with some valuable resources right in Dallas.
Okay.
They have some good answers.
Okay, this happened like a little over a week, and every time I pick up my son right now, I mean, he's crying. He's he has tears in his eyes, but
yeah,
he's not
funny.
Telling me.
Not a good
he's
situation.
Not telling me what. Yeah, he's not telling me. He's not telling me why if he's crying or he's not. He's just not communicating anymore. He's not talking. As soon as we get home, he'll start. Talking, he's fine. But if I ask him what happened in school, how was his day? He's not saying anything. I mean, I don't think they are. I don't know how to say it, but I don't know if they're telling him not to say anything or it's just his little mind that doesn't want to say anything. I just don't understand what's going on.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead, doctor.
Well, there's a lot of questions, and I think it's. Something that needs to be worked on by someone at the local level. and starting with the ASA local chapter in Dallas, that would be a good place to start for references and resources.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
I'll write it down and I'll make sure I call in and find out because what her answer was that they had some procedures that they had to follow in regards to the name calling and the bruise that he had. But they haven't told me anything. And every time they see me come in to drop off my daughter, I have another daughter. She goes to school at 11:45. And every time I come in, they just look at me and they avoid me. They're not, they look at me, but they turn around. I just don't know, you know, anything. I don't know why they're doing that.
Well, it's getting my mommy bear instincts going here. And you have to listen to your gut. If your gut tells you that something's not right, something's not right. And, you know, if it was my child, he would not be going to school tomorrow. He would not be going to school until he has an IEP and until somebody's been notified about the abuse.
Oh, okay.
That's what I would do.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
But, Dr. Tor is right, you know. Check with your local resources like the Autism Society of America Dallas chapter.
Okay.
They should be able to guide you in the right direction as far as some support.
Okay. I've researched a lot of abuse, accusations against teachers, and they always get cleared. I mean, my son, I have no idea how. I think it was like it went over the top that he decided to tell me what's going on. If it gets investigated, I mean, if the teacher doesn't get if they investigate and they're telling my son that he's lying or anything now, if he's not telling the truth, then she's going to still do it to other kids, and that's what I don't want. But
your goal is to protect your child. So
and
you do what
the
you
principal
need to do.
Told me, she told me that this is, we're talking about the best teacher that, she's never had any complaints. She's never had any problems. And the thing is that she told me that she already has another student in his class that has autism and that she's worked with him for 2 years. And that surprised me more because she knows how they act. And even if they don't act the same, they have some similar, you know, actions. And she is not accommodating my son. Why is she accommodating the other boy? I mean, but he's already been tested there. But,
well, you need to need to protect your son. So I would, contact those resources and for sure just listen to your gut.
Okay.
Okay.
And also the how can I help him with the restroom? He can't use the restroom, whatever it is that he needs to use. He has to take his clothes off. Is there any way that we can help him out, or does he just grow out of it? Or?
Well, he needs step-by-step instructions on how to use the restroom. And even somebody modeling for him. So if you can find what you'd want to do is find a male role model you trust in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
My husband can go into the restroom with him, or?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Bring him at school, or?
Well, he can practice at home, and that's one place to start. At school, there should be another person that you can trust who can help him in this area. Perhaps even designing sort of like a schedule of, you know, using pictures. This is what you do when you go to the bathroom. And this is the procedure.
Okay. Well, I'll try that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Dr. Shore, when Sam was little,
yes,
we would, you know, take all of his clothes off and sit him backwards on the bathroom, on the toilet, so he wouldn't make a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that went on for a long time until he was finally, this is, okay, he's big enough now, he should be able to, you know, use the restroom like all the other boys.
Right.
Doesn't have to get completely undressed.
Right.
Well, the change from going from total undressed, sitting backwards on the toilet to try and then get him to stand up was just torture. I don't know what he thought we were trying to do to him, but he would take a fit every time. No, this is not how I do it.
Yeah, it was a change in routine.
Yeah. So I got clever, and I got a piece of construction paper, and I traced around his feet, and mm-hmm. then I put it down in front of the toilet. And then the next time he started to go into the bathroom, he stopped and he looked at that piece of paper, and then it's like the little light bulb went on and he stepped his feet into the outlines, and that was the last time we had to show him.
Oh, that's really neat.
He got it. He's like, oh, that's what you want. Why didn't you just say that?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, that's really funny.
Why didn't you just say that?
Yeah, well, sometimes we make things more complicated than they need to be.
Yeah, I just had to step back and think like Sam for just a minute.
Right, right.
What's he going to understand?
Yeah, exactly. And you did it, and you were successful, and that's great.
It worked.
Yeah.
Not always, but sometimes.
Right, when you get it to work, it's really, really great.
If there's any more callers that would like to ask a question, please just press star 2, and we will get to your questions. I'm going to the ones now that were submitted through the website.
Okay.
Seems that there's some families that are having trouble. One parent accepts the diagnosis and the other one does not. Do you have any advice for families that are dealing with split beliefs?
Yeah, those can be hard. And I think the most important thing to keep in mind is really we need to do what's best for the child, and that in order to do what's best for the child, we need to know what their characteristics are, if there's a name to these characteristics, if there's a label, and in this case it's autism. It doesn't make the child any less than they were before. A child who gets a diagnosis of autism is the same child that they were the day before they got the diagnosis. And really what the diagnosis does is help promote understanding and help to create a way that we can help the child and meet their needs.
I've heard statistics that the divorce rate among parents of special needs kids is much, much, much higher than the typical average. Do you believe that to be true?
There's a lot of controversy about that.
Mm-hmm.
Talking with Robert Nassif, for example, he says that that's a myth, and that there is not a higher divorce rate in children on the autism spectrum. There is this persistent figure of an 80% divorce rate. I'm not sure where it's coming from. I think what is important to realize is that when in a family where there's a child with autism, there is a much greater amount of stress for that family. And the challenge we're faced with is how to meet what is causing the stress and how to help the family be as healthy and functional as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a couple more hands raised here.
Okay.
Hi, caller.
Hi.
Hi.
It's me again.
Hi.
Yeah, I had another issue as far as toothbrushing. We try to promote proper hygiene, and we are trying to get him to brush his teeth. At the preschool that he goes to, they have toothbrushing in part of their curriculum. Children are encouraged to brush their teeth after each meal, breakfast and lunch. And he seems to follow the protocol in school, but he takes the brush and he puts it to the mouth, but he doesn't really, you know, do anything with it. I know he's not going to master that because he's only two. But at home, it's a nightmare in the morning because we give it to him, we let him play with it, we bought him, you know, special toothpaste, and we let him explore with it. But when it comes to actually brushing, it's a nightmare. He screams every morning. We try singing, counting. Now the teacher mentioned, okay, count a specific number, up to a specific number all the time so he could know that when he brushes his teeth, it's up to, let's say, 20. So we're going to try that. But otherwise, it's a nightmare. And I really try to pick my battles in the morning, you know, because I don't want him to be upset and stuff. But we really want to promote proper hygiene for him, and it's really difficult. And the OT says, it's sensory, leave him alone. He's not going to master it. Don't even bother. And we just want to continue. So, any suggestions?
Well, I don't know if I'd ever take the tact of he's never going to master it, never bother, because we don't know what the potential is of somebody on the autism spectrum to learn a task, to overcome a challenge, or to accomplish something. So really what I think is important to focus on is what is presenting the challenge. And often with brushing teeth, it is a sensory issue. And that is something that the occupational therapist should be dealing with.
Yeah.
How to meet the sensory challenge.
Yeah, that's why I sent in a toothbrush and everything for her, and her thing is, oh, well, you know, we don't expect him to really master this until, children don't really do this until 2.5 or 3, and he's 2, and she's just trying to move along because he's getting early intervention, and he's supposed to move on to the next level by the summer. So she's just trying to move along. So she really doesn't have time to focus on this with him, because she's just trying to get through what she has to get through by the summer when he transitions on to the next level, which is CPSC. So I have to really try to continue with this on my own. So this is what I was trying to find out.
Right. Well, it takes a child, as long as it takes them to learn whatever they need to learn, and these parameters aren't governed by when an academic year ends or when you go on to the next agency. The goal is really just is to provide for what their needs are.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said to her, I said, I know he's little. He's not going to, you know, of course he'll eventually know how to do this, but I just want it to be a little easier for him, because I hate when he cries so much, because when, you know, we're not trying to harm him, we're just trying to encourage him and have him incorporate this into his day-to-day activity.
That's right.
Yeah, basic hygiene. And so I don't want him to cry. I don't want him to get so upset in the morning, because it might ruin his day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So this is trying to make it easier on him so he doesn't get so upset.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you've got the right idea. You know what needs to be done, and of course the challenge is getting it done.
Yeah.
That's what you say.
Yeah, I get it done. I do, but it's like, oh my God.
Easier said than done.
Yeah. Mhm.
But you know, again, this is where you know, finding resources such as the local Autism Society of America chapter looking for an advocate. That may be what's really needed to get these people to do what they're obligated to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree. I concur.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I know. We had to sit on our daughter, who is not on the spectrum. We had to sit on her for her first 3 years to brush her teeth. So it's not just isolated to the autism spectrum.
No. We don't corner the market on sensory.
No, we don't. We didn't know at the time what it was, but I know that that was the routine.
Right.
But, yeah, OTs should have at their disposal, you know, all the tools that they need to desensitize the mouth. I know.
Yeah, that's right.
I get all those catalogs, and they have all those little vibrating tools and all kinds of things that...
Oh, yeah, there's a lot out there.
...that the OT should be using.
Right.
Don't let them off the hook just because the school year's ending.
Yeah, that's right.
We are getting toward the end of our conversation here. I wondered if there was anything that we haven't discussed yet that you think would be important to share.
Well, I think a really important thing to share is that, even when things really are difficult and there's a lot of challenges, it's important to keep in mind that the potential of your child with autism or student with autism, it's really limitless. It's unlimited. And really what our challenge is to figure out how to access this potential so that that person has the best shot possible at leading a fulfilling and productive life.
There was a quote in here I was looking for that was in this article, and it was talking about, oh, here it is, the challenge to all who work with this population is to bring them as far and as fast as possible to the lighter end of the spectrum.
Right. And what that means specifically is moving to a point where the child or adult achieves the greatest success possible in interacting with others, getting along in their environment, leading a productive and fulfilling life, and most importantly, being happy with who they are.
I think that what you've said this evening is that your family's love was most instrumental to you.
Yeah, I would agree.
Love and acceptance.
That's right. Accepting me for who I was, but at the same time, understanding that there were significant challenges that needed to be overcome if I were to lead a fulfilling and productive life.
Well, if we don't leave with anything else tonight, I think it's important to remember that they are first children.
That's right.
And then secondary is, or even thirdary, is the autism.
Right. In helping people be as successful and productive as possible and being happy with who they are, with the characteristics they have, finding ways to look at these characteristics and to use them as strengths wherever possible.
I think that's wonderful. I want to thank you for being with us tonight and for sharing all of your wonderful insight. You articulate it so well, what it's like to be on the spectrum, but you're also so knowledgeable about how to address some of the issues. And I just appreciate you sharing all this with us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure to do so.
And maybe we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, let's do that. I look forward to doing it again.
I do hope everyone will join us next month on March 9th when we welcome Dr. Kathy Pratt. She'll be here talking about behavior. So that'll be March 9th from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And she's just as funny as you are, Dr. Shore.
Well, I've known Dr. Pratt for quite a number of years, and I've seen her present several times. And I can definitely vouch for her knowledge in this area of behavior. And considering the person with autism, not just as a collection of behaviors to be modified, but as a whole person, and finding the best way to, one, figure out what is causing the behavior, and then, two, learning how to meet the challenges that some behaviors create.
I've seen her speak a number of times, and she always does that duh thing, like the common sense, why didn't everybody think of that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she's just packed with common sense.
She really is.
Yeah.
And it makes you smack yourself on the forehead and go, oh, I should have thought of that.
Yeah, it really does. Really does.
Would you one more time give your website address so people can visit?
Sure. My website address is www.autismasperger.net. And at this website, there is also a link to send me an email should any further questions come up that haven't been addressed in this webinar.
Very nice. I also want to let all of our listeners know that if you want a transcript of this event, please join our Spectrum Gold Club by clicking the button on the screen on our MomsFightingAutism.com website. And we will send you a copy of the webinar audio and transcript, plus send you 29 other webinars when you join. It's a pretty good deal. It is a good deal. Also, tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or testimonial. Again, that number is 877-211-0212. And I want to thank everyone, especially Dr. Shore,